St. Louis community activist Terrell Carter has written a small book with a big message. The book is Walking the Blue Line, a police officer turned community activist provides solutions to the racial divide. As a former St. Louis police officer and African American, he has more than a little insight into the kinds of things that divide cops from the communities that they serve. As we all know, that divide has been well documented in recent months. Terrell Carter joins me in studio. Great to have you with us. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I know, and having read your book, that you were hassled by cops as a kid, and yet you became one. Why?
Because I had previously been working in the construction industry and found out I was going to be a father, and I was looking for a way to better take care of my family, and I heard an advertisement, a promotion for the police department on the radio, and called a friend who had been a sergeant at the time and asked for his advice. Again, I had not had positive experiences with police. I grew up in a neighborhood where police were not welcome, and they did not necessarily appreciate the neighborhood or the people within the neighborhood that they patrolled. And when I spoke to this gentleman, to this sergeant, he told me the good, the bad, things that I could expect, but he also told me about the opportunities that a position like that would present, and so I decided to go for it and got into the academy in about 3 months.
Before we talk specifically about the time you were on the force, you left after 5 years. Why did you leave?
There were a combination of things. I did not enjoy the job. I was burned out. I was extremely burned out. But in addition to that, ultimately, I had a partner who I was going to have to testify against for falsifying a police report and making some false arrests. And I knew that when that happened, when I said yes, that I would cooperate with federal prosecutors, I knew that I would not be able to survive on the department after that.
Why wouldn't you have been able to survive?
Because you don't snitch on another police officer. You don't tell on another police officer. You essentially go along with the program and do what you're expected to do. And when you don't do that, life can become very hard for you on the department.
That was alluded to in the report from Rachel from We Hear Now just a few moments ago. I would think that that would tend to be a very corrosive kind of thing if you have to protect other officers, whether they were in the right or wrong.
It can be a corrosive thing. And again, that's one of the main reasons why I left. There are multiple officers who feel like that, but we have to be truthful. There are officers who are okay with that kind of system. And so they are able to make their career regardless of those kinds of things, unfortunately. Or fortunately, I was not one of those officers.
Right. I should point out that when you left the department, you went on to a great many other vocations, if you will. I have the list here. You're executive director of the North Newstead Association now, site coordinator and director at the Central Baptist Theological Seminary in St. Louis, adjunct instructor at St. Louis Community College in Wildwood. So you got a very full plate since having left the police department.
Yes, sir.
Terrell, why would anyone want to become a police officer in today's environment, do you think?
In today's environment, I really don't know. I mean, there's obviously the idea of protecting and serving. And I truthfully believe that for some people, jobs like law enforcement are a calling, that it is something that they wholeheartedly believe in, going into a community, helping people, making a difference in people's lives. And for some people, they're like me, it was simply a job, and it provided certain benefits and certain opportunities.
What do you make of what police officers in various parts of the country, and certainly here, are going through these days?
That's a varied question, because some of the things that are occurring to officers and to police departments or law enforcement are things that are out of their control, but some of the things are because of their own actions, because of actions and attitudes that have been displayed for years and years. So in writing the book, my goal was to try to show both sides of the situation, not to villainize police officers, but also not to defend them either, as well as not to villainize citizens, but not to defend citizens either. None of this has a simple answer. We are all human. We all have our own quirks. The systems that we live in, the systems that we work and that we operate in have been in existence for a long time. And those systems, the things that need to be changed about those systems will not change unless those things are brought to light.
Do you have any sense the change is coming? There's a lot of talk, and we'll be talking about it on this program tomorrow, some very active proposals for police reform. Do you have any sense that that is coming, that's really going to happen?
I do. I think that there has been a great amount of light shone onto these situations, which, you know, is making sure that the conversation stays current, that the conversation is relevant. So I think that in the short term, there are some things that are going to be done. So there are some changes that are going to occur. For me, the question is, 5 years from now, will we have forgotten about all of this and moved on and the cycle start all over again? This is not the first time that these kinds of things have happened. This is not the first time these kinds of things have been brought to light. And it seems like through history, they get attention for a certain amount of time. Then everyone thinks or acts like everything is fine. They, you know, it becomes something that goes on the back burner until someone shoots someone, until someone does something to someone, and it becomes a hot button issue again.
Well, look how many times it's happened since Michael Brown was shot. There does seem to be a different momentum at the current period.
Right. And I think that we were talking off air that I think that the fact that we have so much social media involved and so many people that are paying attention to it now that have the ability or have the savvy to broadcast these things. In the book, I talk about the fact that police officers, when I went through the academy, were taught that they have the magic pen, which means that when a police officer says it, it's the gospel truth. Well, fortunately, now you have people who have cell phone cameras and all these other things that help to show the fuller picture, which, you know, can bring into question or bring to light something that a police officer said or did not say or did or did not do. And as long as people have this technology, I think that it's going to help keep the conversation current and keep it relevant.
Do you think it's more difficult for a black man or woman to be a police officer today than a white officer?
I don't know if it's more difficult. I think that they face certain challenges that white officers don't. But I would also say that white officers face challenges that black officers don't face. I think that when black officers go into a black community, one of the concerns that the citizenry has is, are you coming in here to try to impress someone, or are you really coming in here to do good in the neighborhood? You know, so you have that type of scrutiny that comes from your community, that, and the anticipation or the expectation is that as a black officer, you were raised in a black community and you probably experienced the things that these citizens have experienced. So why would you come into our neighborhood and try to, you know, act like a cowboy? Again, the questions are you trying to impress these white officers, or are you really trying to do something to try to help people?
Now, I've heard that often black officers find that they are as disliked as much or even more perhaps than white officers, being turncoats, if you
right.
will.
Right. Or the word I've been called multiple times, and I've heard other black officers called as a sellout. Again, it's the anticipation or the expectation that as a black officer, you should come in with a much more sympathetic ear than a white officer. And if you don't show that sympathy, then, you know, you have an ulterior motive.
I'd like to talk about some specific recommendations you have, but before we get to that, I'll have to take a break. And before we do that, I want to ask about one thing in your book that surprised me.
Okay.
And that is that you are not an opponent, necessarily, of racial profiling.
I am not. I'm not an opponent, necessarily, of any kind of profiling, because at its core, profiling is one tool to help with an investigation. And what I mean by that is if someone looks out of place, then that's a key or a clue that can help an investigation. If a person, I give an example in the book, I patrolled a neighborhood that was known for drug activity, or I patrolled multiple neighborhoods that were known for drug activity. And they were primarily African-American, and white people did not live in the neighborhood. And typically when a white person was there, they were there to try to buy drugs. And, you know, after I learned that, it became more familiar with that, I used that as a tool in performing investigations. And sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't work. The idea, though, is that you do not arrest someone based on that. it's supposed to be a tool to help you as part of your investigation. And if that investigation leads you to an arrest, then you have done the things that you should have done. I'm not for just stopping someone and arresting someone because they're black and they're in the wrong place or because they are white and they are in the wrong place. But if the phrase I use in the book is if it doesn't fit, if they don't fit, then you should start asking questions, which will lead to more.
Is it fair to say, do you think that it's a tool used by most police officers today?
I would say yes. And the unfortunate thing is it probably is the primary tool that does not get as much they don't use it as much as an investigative tool as it is a tool just to stop people and to arrest people.
Which is an experience you had as a young man on more than one occasion.
Well, not just that. It was an experience that I had as a police officer watching other officers arrest someone simply because they were black or simply because they were white.
We're talking to Terrell Carter, who is a former police officer in the city of St. Louis, turned community activist after 5 years on the force. He is the author of the book Walking the Blue Line, in which he talks about his experiences and his certain recommendations as to how police and the people in the communities that they serve can get along a little bit better, unlike some of the things we've been seeing recently on television and hearing from other parts of the country. We'll come back and continue the conversation with Terrell Carter in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Terrell Carter, author of Walking the Blue Line. He is a former St. Louis City police officer. Very quickly, before we get to your recommendations, Terrell, you have three things you pointed out that were a problem during your policing days. I suspect they still may be. We can just deal with them very quickly. Your concern about statistics and the fact that the departments are very, very concerned about statistics, about anger on the part of police officers, and about cynicism on the part of police officers. Just go over those quickly, if you would.
Well, as it relates to stats, the way for you to be promoted on the police department is to be what they call a go-getter or someone who is a real police officer is what I used to hear it called. And that was a person who was willing to make arrests, to write tickets, to do all those different things. The department is not designed, and the system itself is not designed to help people or to build relationships. It's designed to, you go from call to call. And in order for you to become a valued officer or to prove your worth, the best way to do that and the way that commanders pay attention to is when you build your stats. I mean, you have a report that comes out monthly that tells you how many arrests you made. And, you know, I remember sergeants and lieutenants telling me, if you can't make an arrest or if you can't make a certain number of arrests, then you're not even trying. And I get what they meant by that. I mean, the idea that most people don't realize that they violate numerous traffic laws as they drive a 1 to 3 block span. But that doesn't mean that you have to write tickets to people. And truthfully, you can arrest someone for almost anything, for a peace disturbance on a regular basis. But is that the best thing to do? One of the concerns that I have and have always had with the department is it's primarily about making big drug arrests or things like that. And again, to be someone that is highly valued, you have to do those kinds of things. Those are the sexy, big time things that will get you made sergeant or lieutenant or, you know, whatever rank it is, or be transferred to become a detective. And it gets officers away from the idea of necessarily making their first concern helping people. You know, they answer radio calls and it's about going from call to call so I can go and do some real police work, which again, doesn't allow them, as in the sections we heard before we came on the air, it doesn't allow them to do, you know, community-based policing. It doesn't allow them to build relationships and to find out really what's going on in the neighborhood as well. The second idea of anger is most of the police officers I know, or a lot of police officers I know, are angry, but there's a reason for that. It's because they deal with drama all day. No one calls 911 when things are going well. They only call 911 when things are going bad. And it's always a high or predominantly a high stress situation. So officers are on guard constantly. And you can't go to work for 8 hours a day every day without that changing you and affecting you. And that was one of the problems that I had. I became a different person. I was angry all the time. I saw people as the same. So every, you know, young black man, even though we may have came from the same neighborhood, I would see them as a criminal because that's all I dealt with on a daily basis. And that also leads to cynicism as well. One of the things that I say is that you can't blame a white officer who has not been raised around black people for them to go and patrol a neighborhood and for that to be their only point of reference or those black people. You can't necessarily get mad at them for forming certain ideas about the black community because that's the only reference point they have. So the question is, how do we help officers with those things? How do we help officers with the anger and the cynicism?
That's why I want to go to your recommendation. It's just one point, though, that I'll make here with regard to the stats. There are some communities in our area, and I'm sure in other parts of the country, too, where those stats represent cold, hard cash because that's how the communities subsist.
You're right, and that's what we just experienced in Ferguson and multiple other places as well. And again, that's, you know, one of the good things that's coming out of all this is the reforms that are taking place. Again, the question is, how soon and how long will those reforms stay in place?
We'll be talking, as I mentioned earlier, tomorrow on this program about reforms proposed by the Ferguson Commission. Mm-hmm. There have been several, and we'll see how that goes. Let's get down your list here. You have some ideas for what citizens, communities can do and also what the officers can do. Some we've already addressed. I'll go through them quickly. Number one, make professional counseling available to officers.
Yep.
This, I guess, to deal with the anger and cynicism issues you just addressed.
Right. One of the things, you know, one of the harrowing statistics is that, you know, police officers have some of the highest rates of divorce as well as suicide in our nation.
Yep. The next one, and this deals with the families as well and the families of police officers who are often the forgotten people in this equation. They face a very tough life, too, because of what their husbands or wives do. Departments should work to counteract stigmas officers and their families face. What can departments do?
Well, I mean, part of it is one of the things I've begun to say is that we have to see everyone as human. We have to see police officers as human. Commanders have to see their subordinates as human. And don't forget, it's not – so one of the problems with all this chasing statistics is that commanders make that their focus, and they will push their officers to do those things and not be concerned about how it affects officers and not be concerned about how it affects their time with their families and, again, how it changes officers and causes them or to become something different or all those different things. It has to be a priority. Mental health, emotional health has to become a priority. And again, incorporating family members into that process of, because who's the best person to tell you that my husband or wife is not doing well right now?
It's the family members, obviously. A couple of things we've already addressed here. Establish a process where officers can safely report other officers who commit wrongdoing. We've talked about that. Eliminate the stats culture. We've talked about that. Establish citizen patrol academies.
Well, St. Louis has one, but St. Louis had one, and from what I understand, it has not occurred lately, and it had not occurred in a while before the book was published. The point is to incorporate citizens into this process of policing. It helps the police department, but in addition to that, it will help citizens understand what police officers go through. Again, part of my reason for writing this book is to give the general public an idea of what a police officer may go through. And if you can train citizens, here's an appropriate time to call 911. This, you know, because there's a dog or because there is a light out, or that's probably not an appropriate time to call 911. There are other city departments that handle those kinds of things.
I said in promoting this program that this is a two-way street. It's
right.
Not all things that law enforcement can do. The community has some responsibility as well.
Exactly.
Citizen review boards, something you're in favor of and something the city of St. Louis has now established.
But the question or the concern is who is going to be on that citizen review board? I mean, the same question comes up when it came to the Ferguson Commission. Are people being invited to the commission or people being invited to citizen review boards because someone owes them a political favor, or is it because this person legitimately cares about the neighborhood, the community? And so that brings up the question of how do we select people? Should it be in a political appointment? Should it be presented to the citizens for them to recommend someone? And I understand that there are always going to be questions about, you know, the department's going to want to control a certain part of this process. But it's not just about the department. It's about the citizens as well.
We should point out that police departments can be very political entities.
I wouldn't even say can be. I would say that they just in general are very political entities.
Internally and subject to outside political influence.
Yes, sir.
Cultural sensitivity training, this seems to me to be an obvious one.
Right. It is. Again, so you can understand, again, if you have, and I'm continuing to use the black-white example, I mean, it would be beneficial to make sure that the officers that are patrolling neighborhoods understand the different cultures that they are going to. And I give the example in the book of me going on a call to a household where the family members were Korean, and I made a cultural mistake that I did not even know that I was making, which made it extremely hard for me to find out what was going on. And after that mistake was acknowledged, then things became better. But I would have never known that. I would not know that until I walked in or unless an older, more experienced officer would have told me that.
Just patting a child on the head in some cultures is an insult.
Just speaking to a woman alone, you know, before you speak to the husband, which was the circumstance that I found myself in, may put me at odds with the father, the husband, and the household.
It's a big deal. There's no question about it. Now, as to what communities can do. Neighborhood organizations should be established?
Yes, sir. These are organizations that have a relationship with people in the neighborhood that can serve as a resource. Again, police officers cannot do everything. That is not their job to try to fix everything. If we had organizations or groups that people could go to, and there are organizations like the one that I run, the North Newstead Association. There are multiple other religious entities, but people have to – it would be beneficial if people took advantage of those kinds of organizations that already exist.
Parents can play a big role by teaching their kids how to interact with officers.
This seems like the most obvious one.
Yeah.
You know, we have – you can see it on television. There, I remember 2 days ago where a family they got a police officer to go in and to handcuff their child and put him in the back of a police car, which is ridiculous. That is not mm-hmm. what police are there for. If we have to teach – we have to live this out ourselves but also teach – our future generations, that police are not necessarily the enemies and police are there to help and that they do have a certain level of authority and that authority has to be respected. We have to teach them that when you're around a police officer, make sure the police officer knows where your hands are, because that is one of the things that they're always taught. Don't let someone put their hands in their pockets or put them in a place where you can't see them. It's just the simple things of yes, sir, no, sir. If a police officer pulls you over, make sure your hands are on the steering wheel. Don't make any quick movements. You know, it's just really simple things that many of us have already been taught, but it seems that a new generation has not been.
I'll lump two together here as time begins to move along on us. Leadership in communities and community cooperation, they seem to go together. Establish some community leadership.
Yes, sir. Again, it goes back to the idea that the police department cannot – law enforcement can't fix everything. We have to be to a certain point, we have to be responsible for our own communities. There's a program called the Neighborhood Ownership Model, which St. Louis spearheaded last year through the Circuit Attorney's Office. And it's a wonderful program where citizens band together to help identify crime, to help victims of crime, to help them find the resources that they need. The idea is that it takes some of the pressure, some of the expectation off of law enforcement. But in another sense, it gives the community a way to buy in and to help one another and to form relationships as well, which helps everyone in the end.
Do you buy into the broken window strategy? That is, when crack down on small crimes so that it prevents more serious crimes from occurring?
I understand the value or the intent behind it. My question would be, does it really work? So your question is, do I buy into it? Not necessarily. I think that part of if we start looking at statistics, we will see that there are a lot of broken window crimes that are managed or are handled or responded to in the city of St. Louis alone. But has it really done anything to help the crime rate? Has it done anything really to help the neighborhoods, the people in the neighborhoods? Again, I do see some value in it, but it should not be the sole indicator or motivating force. It has to be part of a much bigger tool bag.
As a community activist, are you seeing or have you found that the community leadership we just talked about and the community cooperation is something that is developing or increasing?
In some neighborhoods, it is, and in some neighborhoods, it's not. Again, my organization helped to manage the NOM, the Neighborhood Ownership Model process, in a few wards in North St. Louis. And for a certain sector, that was a very beneficial program. Part of it is, again, it takes more than just – leadership is more than just the citizens by themselves, that you have to have the aldermen, alderwomen, alderperson present and active, the city departments that help those particular neighborhoods have to be present and, you know, responsive as well. So this is – our city, this whole – kind of circumstance situation is not going to be fixed by just one group. It's going to take multiple people working together.
Only a little over a minute left, and there is a proposal that's just been put out recently here by the organization Better Together, and a new report has been issued by a national group saying that St. Louis's fragmented policing is a problem. Do you see it that way?
I do. I agree with that report in many ways because each department is motivated by different things. Some is motivated by revenue generation, which you have mentioned before. When you have all the different political wranglings that occur, people are not on the same page. Again, it's going to take unified work to get these kinds of things fixed.
And getting back to the police departments and officers themselves, two other recommendations you have, which I don't think will surprise people. One is that better pay for police officers, right, and a better standard of education for them.
Yes. Again, this is one of the reasons, another motivating factor for me, which was a smaller one, was the fact that, you know, I just finished a doctorate degree 2 weeks ago. When I left the department with my master's degree, I was making less money than, you know, union construction people. And that's not to disrespect people who are in union construction. But I was carrying a gun, you know, putting my life on the line on a daily basis, and people who were doing a quarter of the job I was doing were making a lot more money than me.
You know, I've mentioned this many times in the program, but when you left your home every day as a police officer, was your first thought, am I going to come home tonight?
Yes, it was. I have my son is 17 now, but at the time he was 2, and I had just gotten custody of him, so I was raising him by myself with the help of my grandparents. And every day my thought was, it doesn't matter what happens on duty. I have to get home to this little boy every day.
I have to get home. And all police officers think the same way.
I would imagine.
That's Terrell Carter, a police officer turned community activist, 5 years on the St. Louis PD. His book is Walking the Blue Line, where he goes into detail about the recommendations we've talked about. Terrell, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
That's it for us today. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about police training and the Ferguson Commission's latest recommendations, as I've indicated. We'll also take a look at a program to increase the high school graduation rate by reducing teen pregnancy. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis on the Air, a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.